Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Captain Edward T. Hudson, ACM number 37249. Appellant presents three issues for our consideration today. They are whether the military judge improperly admitted evidence of uncharged allegations under military rules of evidence 414 and 404B, whether the military judge erred in refusing to admit Defense Exhibit B for identification on the basis of lack of authentication, and whether appellant received effective assistance of trial defense counsel. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Chief Judge, we'd like to reserve 10 minutes, please.
Very well, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Drew, Senior Judge Brown, and Judge Mink. I am Zachary Spillman, and along with Captain Encarnacion Miranda, we represent Captain Hudson, the appellant in this case. The central theme of the trial of Captain Hudson was that he is a child molester. His defense counsel needed to present evidence to rebut that theme, and they needed to present evidence that his accusers were liars. They did neither. Instead, they opened the door to the prior trial and conviction. That was deficient performance, and there is more than a reasonable probability that it affected the outcome. The theme that Captain Hudson is a child molester was based on the uncharged allegation of MP admitted for propensity purposes. MP's claim predated the charged offense by more than 5 years with no intervening allegations, a significant remoteness factor that the military judge failed to appreciate. It caused a distracting mini-trial, and it invited the trial defense counsel's closing argument that, and I quote, the scariest part of the Air Force, to think that someone like the accused is among us, someone like him as an officer, and wears our same uniform. That argument was a wholly improper argument on a highly inflammatory theme that was in no way proof of Captain Hudson's guilt of the charged offense. And this court cannot be confident that Captain Hudson was convicted on the basis of the evidence alone. I want to start, Your Honors, however, with the issue that you specified for oral argument today, the military judge's ruling on admission of Defense Exhibit B. This issue involves what is an obvious error, but less obvious prejudice. The military judge's ruling was based on authentication. She ruled on page 1,404 of the record that altogether I'm not satisfied about the authentication of Defense Exhibit B for identification, so I'm not admitting it into evidence. This ruling was a credibility determination based on the testimony of J.O., Captain Hudson's ex-wife, who denied sending the email. But such issues of credibility, however, are for the trier of fact, not for the military judge. They go to weight, not admissibility. The exclusion of this email was error, and it was prejudicial error because it was J.O. who first reported C.G.'s allegations to authorities, C.G. being the named charged victim, and J.O. had physical custody of and raised M.P., who was the uncharged alleged victim.
Counsel, what was the relationship of J.O. to C.G., C.G. being the actual victim or alleged victim in this case?
There was no family relationship, Your Honor, but there was a relationship in terms of how the reporting was done.
And when you say there was no family relationship, just to be clear, was there any testimony that suggested that J.O. ever met or even saw C.G. In a personal capacity, interacted in any way?
There was not, okay. to my memory, Your Honor.
And so then can you help me a little bit? So what is the connection then between J.O.? How is J.O. so critical here in this case, where J.O. has not even talked to the victim that is making these allegations here?
Your Honor, I'd like to break that up into two parts, because you have how she's critical for M.P., who was the propensity alleged victim, and how she's critical for C.G., who's the charged alleged victim. For M.P., she's M.P.'s mom, and fundamentally the defense theory of the case, a defense theory of the case, was that J.O. put M.P. up to this. The for C.G., it's a little more attenuated, and you know, we have to acknowledge that it's more attenuated. C.G. Initially reported to S.H., who is J.O.'s other daughter and appellant's natural daughter. S.H. reported to J.O., J.O. reported to authorities. And so she's in that chain. But and this is in the weeds of the facts of the case, Your Honor, but the report that C.G., the alleged victim on the charged offense, made to S.H., the other girl, was after S.H. told C.G. about M.P.'s report. So if J.O. put M.P. up to it, if J.O. implanted this into the imagination of these 8-9-year-old girls, then that is how she implicates the allegation that C.G., who she never met, never really knew, at trial. And that is fundamentally their theory of the case, or a theory of the case. But the issue is that the Defense Exhibit B, this email that was not admitted, was powerful evidence of J.O.'s hatred of appellant. I mean, it was her sort of seething prejudice against him and the reason she would have done things like put children up to making such false allegations. Without that email, the defense was deprived of actual evidence of her hatred of him. The military judge even instructed the members that, and this was at 994 and 995 of the record, that the defense counsel's questions in cross-examination about the email were not evidence that the email existed. And so they were stuck in this box at that point.
All right, so we're talking in terms of authentication. Now, isn't the issue of authentication limited to documentary evidence? In other words, the admission of the email itself, not necessarily testimony about an email.
I would say that's true, Your Honor.
All right. So is there... in this case, did the defense counsel put on any evidence of witnesses, maybe it's the appellant, maybe it's OH, who said, hey, I received an email from this email account, I thought it was J.O., and this is what she told me.
So they did that in a 39A, Your Honor. Right?
Who did they put on, who testified that they received the email?
There was an airman who testified, I've forgotten his name, it begins with G, the defense paralegal who went into the email account and retrieved the message.
Okay, all right, so, but he didn't testify that he said, this is how I got it, I just got it, I watched the appellant go into the Yahoo server and I printed it out, right? That's what we have. So we still don't have anyone that testified, hey, I got this email, and this is when I got this email, and this is what the email said. In other words, what I'm driving at is this, is when we talk in terms of authentication of a document, isn't that in some way different than when someone can testify about this is what I heard, this is what I saw, this is the email that I received?
Yes and no, Your Honor. What I'd say is that authentication is some evidence that it is what it purports to be. And there are so many different ways to do it. I mean, distinctive markings, distinctive characteristics and the like is one way to do it. And the email on its header had distinctive markings and characteristics.
Tracking. All right. And I recognize I'm probably not doing a good job of focusing you in on where I'm trying to go, which is, wasn't the judge's ruling excluding the email just prohibiting the evidence in that form? There is nothing that precluded, because you talked in terms of this ruling precluded the members from hearing or seeing this evidence, but there's nothing that precluded, at least in that ruling, the defense from putting on evidence of someone that received the email to say, hey, I got an email from J.O. that said this.
I understand, Your Honor. I'd like to try to answer your question in two ways. The first way is that what the military judge's ruling was, at its core, was a ruling that she did not believe that the email came from J.O. She believed that somebody else authored the email. And that was a fundamental question of weight, not admissibility. That was a fundamental question for the members. The question of could the defense have presented the same evidence, say perhaps through testimony by the appellant, by Captain Hudson himself, I think that raises the issue of you have a question of the bias of J.O. that only he could rebut. Right? I mean, it creates a situation where he has to give up his right to remain silent to do something that should have been allowed anyway. Right? And so it's not sort of an alternative way of admissibility. It's why it was prejudicial to refuse to admit on authentication grounds based on credibility, which is a question for the members.
All right. And
Your Honor, I'd like to give you an analogy, if I could, please. So say you have a garden variety wrongful use of a controlled substance case. You have a urinalysis. And the observer comes in and testifies that they watched the urine leave the accused body and go into the cup. And that's why you should admit the resulting urinalysis. And the judge says, you know, I just don't believe you. I don't think somebody would watch somebody pee into a cup. I don't think you're being forthright on the stand. So I'm not going to allow the urinalysis in because I don't believe your testimony on authentication grounds. I don't believe you've authenticated this urinalysis as being the product of his urine, the accused's urine. That sort of ruling, I think that that is the ruling that the government's briefs ask this court to affirm. And I think that we think that it is a ruling of unlimited applicability, right? It just, there's no limiting factor for that sort of issue.
Now, what is the standard of, if we find that the military judge erred in this case, what is the standard, how do we evaluate prejudice? Is this a constitutional error, or is this the normal normal error where the appellant must demonstrate prejudice?
Well, either way, the government has to demonstrate harmlessness because this is a preserved error, right? This is something the defense sought to introduce, and it was erroneously kept out at the urging of the prosecution. So either way, it's on them to show that the error was harmless because they benefited from it at trial. Whether or not it's harmless or harmless beyond a reasonable doubt turns on whether or not you believe it's a constitutional error. And we don't think they need either standard. So we don't think you have to go that far. We don't think that they can prove basic harmlessness.
And actually, that's one of the reasons I was asking about, isn't this ruling not excluding the substance of the testimony? In other words, it impacted how this witness or how this witness would be attacked, email or testimony. It didn't preclude the ability to cross-examine. And so my question, and you've answered my question, I think, at least to the extent that I need it, is that potentially could help at least this court in determining whether or not that is a constitutional error or whether or not that's just the normal type of error that we analyze.
Well, I understand your question, Your Honor, I think, and I think I understand your point, and we respectfully disagree with it because the military judge instructed the members that the substance of the email, the substance of the cross-examination, the actual bias and prejudice against Captain Hudson embodied in J.O. had not been proven.
All right,
and that was an affirmative instruction given at the time of the cross-examination.
And do you believe that that was an accurate statement of the law at the time that it was given?
It was, Your Honor, because they had only crossed, and that's why they needed to introduce the email. Now, the email contains few and discreet references to the prior trial that could have been easily redacted. We've offered an appellate exhibit at this point, which shows some of the redactions that could have been made. But it didn't matter at that point, the references to the prior trial, because counsel's deficient performance in opening the door to the prior trial had already been made an issue. And that turns to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. A defense counsel asked J.O. 12 questions about the email. It's record pages 958 to 961. Only two of those questions referenced the prior trial. At other times during the case, there were references to prior hearings or prior military proceedings, particularly in the cross-examination of C.G., the named alleged victim, the charged alleged victim. Those references were subtle. They were carefully crafted to avoid opening the door. It was a door that everyone had agreed before trial should stay closed. The questions of J.O. could easily have been the same, but they weren't. Instead, counsel explicitly referenced the first court-martial and Captain Hudson's confinement. And it was wholly unnecessary to reference the prior trial in order to show J.O.'s bias for the purpose of impeachment. The failure to do so opened the door to evidence of the prior trial that prejudiced Captain Hudson, just as the parties had recognized it would.
What evidence came in once the door was open?
So the military judge ruled that the existence of the prior court-martial, but not the sentence, was now a fair issue.
All right. So how does that prejudice the appellant?
Well, we believe that it it does two things, Your Honor. Right. It first bolsters the propensity argument that was the central theme of this case, that he is a child molester, he is a bad person, so that's why he's guilty. I mean, fundamentally, that was the closing argument. You know that the elements are met because he did it to both of them. Those are the words of the trial counsel.
Did it come before the members that he was previously convicted of incidents involving both MP as well as CG? Or did it not get into that specific?
I don't think it was that specific, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the implication is there, particularly considering the thing you heard in the opening statement, where trial counsel referenced the statute of limitations and why you're going to hear from MP, the uncharged victim, but you're not going to see her on the charge sheet. I mean, it has now piled on to that implication that maybe can be dismissed as insignificant when it happened. As the military judge said, that's a non-factor and just look past it. But as you continue to add things to it that reemphasize that point, that's what makes it prejudicial. Now, a tactical decision must be objectively reasonable. But here we have the reasons, and they are objectively flawed. It's particularly clear when you look at the assertion of ineffective assistance of counsel regarding the failure to present evidence of Captain Hudson's good character. The suspiciously similar declarations of Captain Hudson's trial defense counsel reveal that they did not present evidence of his good character or rebut the prosecution theme that he is a child molester simply because they don't think such a defense is effective. But Captain Hudson had the right to be tried by the members, not by his defense team. His good character was both rebuttal to the prosecution theme that he's a child molester, and it is a wholly independent reason for the members to find him not guilty. Its omission cannot possibly be said to have had no effect on the outcome of the trial.
It seems like in every case, trial defense counsel appropriately make tactical decisions, and to suggest that the appellant had the right to be tried by the members, which is obviously the case, and not his counsel, would seem to suggest that his counsel are not permitted to use their professional judgment. And my understanding is both of these defense counsel were very experienced. In fact, I believe they were both former trial judges themselves. So they had some degree of knowledge that they were bringing to bear. But certainly, it's their obligation, it seems like you're arguing that very thing, for them to use their professional knowledge, skill, and experience in advising their client and in making tactical decisions, recognizing that not all decisions need be made by the appellant or the accused at that stage personally. Would you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. And further, we accept that they have to use their best judgment, their professional judgment, in determining which defense to present. But here, we have two things. First, we have the centrality of this as a defense, both because it rebuts the primary prosecution theme of the case and also because it's its own defense. And respectfully, we point the court to our reply brief at pages 14 and 15, where there is a table describing defense exhibits Delta through November, which were introduced in sentencing, that outline all of the good character, all of the different kinds of good character that these witnesses could have offered. You have a lieutenant colonel saying, "I trust Todd implicitly with my daughter." You have a civilian who calls him a devoted father and husband, good and trustworthy human being. This goes beyond good military character, whatever that means. These are specific, pertinent traits that directly rebut the assertion that he's a child molester. And the reason, so that's piece one, is just how central this is. But piece two is the reasons they didn't offer it. And we have that from the declarations. And it really falls into two baskets. Basket one is that they just didn't think it was effective. And that's their own sort of value judgment overriding that of the members. But the members were the ones who had to decide if it was effective or not. And basket two is the things they were afraid of. And the things they were afraid of, Your Honor, were things that could not be admitted under the rule. And we addressed that in our reply brief, that they were worried about some other uncharged allegation being raised and somehow being proven, and they'd have no way to rebut it. And a character defense just can't be rebutted that way. More fundamentally, a character defense can be presented by affidavit. And you can't cross-examine an affidavit. So they had ways to deal with those concerns, insofar as you believe that those are actually the concerns. I mean, you have to, you know, if you take the declarations on their face and you accept that that is the reason why they didn't offer it, then those reasons still fail under the objectively reasonable test. The last thing I want to address on this point of ineffective assistance of counsel is the failure to address the bad character of the alleged victims, charged and uncharged. In this case, there was no eyewitness testimony other than the alleged victims. There was no corroboration. There was no forensic, scientific, or otherwise medical evidence. And they wholly failed to rebut those two witnesses who were crucial to the government's case. I see that I'm running out of time here, Your Honor. So very briefly, on the 414 issue, I just want to highlight that admission of propensity evidence is fundamentally unfair if it undermines the presumption of innocence and the requirement that the prosecution prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We didn't make that up. That's CAF in United States versus Wright, 52 MJ at 481. And with that, I preserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Hello, counsel. Excuse me, government counsel.
Chief Judge Drew, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Tyler Musselman, along with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the United States in this proceeding. Appellant's conviction and sentence was not the result of error in the admission or exclusion of evidence or ineffective assistance of counsel, but instead was the result of credible and corroborated testimony of two child victims proving appellant's guilt well beyond a reasonable doubt. In addressing the issues today, I'd like to first start with Issue 5 regarding authentication, then address Issue 6, appellant's claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, and then touch on Issue 1, the military judge's 414 ruling. Now, regarding authentication, it's the United States' position that appellant has not demonstrated that the military judge's decision to exclude Defense Exhibit B was an abuse of discretion. Even if there was error, and even if such error rose to constitutional implications, which we contend that it does not, there is no prejudice. Now, obviously, with the standard review, an abuse of discretion requires more than just mere disagreement. Here, there's been no clearly erroneous facts that have been identified. When you look at the law the military judge relied on.
Counsel, did you agree that it appears to be the basis of the judge's ruling was a credibility determination? She evaluated the credibility of J.O. on one side, who said she didn't send the email, and evaluated the credibility of S.H. on the other side. She said she didn't do it, and then the judge said, I'm more likely to believe J.O., and I don't believe S.H. I mean, is that the basis, really, when you go down to it, what the ruling was?
No, Your Honor. If you look at the military judge's ruling twice, he says, the most important fact I find is that the email account was accessible by more than one individual.
Okay, and how many individuals had access to that account?
Four, Your Honor.
Four individuals. And what information, and those four individuals were J.O., S.H., as well as M.P., right, who was the 414 victim, and then I think the boyfriend or the wife, the boyfriend or husband of J.O. So there's nothing that would suggest that M.P. or J.O.'s spouse, or boyfriend, girlfriend, would have written those emails. So it seems to come down to there's access, SH could have sent the email, or J.O. could have sent the email. So again, why is that then not coming down to a basic credibility determination? Who do I believe? Do I believe SH? Do I believe J.O.?
Well, Your Honor, SH didn't testify that J.O. sent the email. What you have
he said she didn't, right? And so what? Right. Isn't that the alternative that the judge seemed to be dealing with? As she says, four people had access to that account. One of them was SH. One of them was J.O. I don't believe J.O. I mean, isn't she necessarily saying, I don't believe S.H. when she says she wasn't the one that sent it?
No, I think when you look at MRE 901B4, Your Honor, you're talking about distinctive and unique characteristics. By virtue of the evidence that was put on in regards to this issue, the email itself is not a unique characteristic because there's more than one. It's like if this thing got sent from an org box. So what the judge has to look at is whether or not the proponent has put on unique characteristics. That wasn't put on through the email address because you had multiple people have access to it. Therefore, it's not a unique characteristic.
All right. So your take is, and let's boil it down, I know it's not the facts of this case necessarily, but if the testimony is one of two people sent an email, and one witness said, and they do the pointing at each other thing, that it's perfectly appropriate for the judge to go, I can't make it, I can't decide who it was that sent it, so I'm just not even going to put it forth to the members so that they can make a determination?
Well, I think, once again, you have to look, is it their distinctive and unique characteristics? And under those circumstances, we would argue there's not. That's why you had the military judge look at things like unique language. And you see that, I think, in the authentication cases that were cited by the parties. You have the court looking at multiple factors, not just one and done. And 901B4 itself says taken in conjunction with the circumstances.
And 901B1 through whatever, that specifically just says those are examples, correct?
That's correct.
So it's not like a list of hearsay exceptions where we have to fit it somewhere in there. Those are just one example. All right, well, let me ask you the very basic question then. Do you think that it's appropriate for a military judge to exclude something on authentication grounds solely based on a credibility determination? Of a witness?
I think it depends. But I don't think that we have to answer that here.
All right. I'm asking you what your opinion is. Do you want to? And so I'm giving you an opportunity to assist the court. Would you like to take that opportunity or not?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if the party has made a prima facie case and then there's a credibility determination to be made, then that should be up to the members. What our argument here is that there was no prima facie case made because there are no unique circumstances that lend authentication on these grounds. And that's why you look at the judge, look at the unique language. I don't think it was a credibility determination. It was the fact that there were multiple people that had access. SH didn't testify that she did not have access to the email. So I think there would have been your credibility determination. And regardless, I think that when you get to a prejudice aspect of this case, there simply is none. And there's a number of factors for that. First, I'd like to touch on the burden. Here, appellant, and this is another reason there is no prejudice, was able to cross-examine J.O. line by line on the email. And so as far as his rights to confrontation, they were not impacted in any meaningful way.
All right. And what did the witness say when the defense cross-examined line by line on that email? Did J.O. say, yes, you're right, you got me?
No, she denied it.
She denied it. So what do the members do with that information?
The military judge instructed them that the email was not in evidence, but they could use the answers on the basis of a credibility determination.
What
twice.
Does that mean?
That they could judge her demeanor in court when answering those questions.
Okay. All right. And so your position is asking the question and the person denying it is sufficient for purposes of confrontation?
Yes.
And that would apply even if the issue went to motive or bias that normally defense would be permitted to use extrinsic evidence for?
Yes, and our proposition for that is United States v. Bear, B-A-H-R. And in Bear, you will see the lower court in Bear held that exclusion of certain evidence regarding bias of the victim. The CCA held that it was under the non-constitutional standard. However, when CAF reviewed it, they held that it was a constitutional standard. You'll see in Bear a discussion of exclusion of a diary, but then also exclusion of cross-examination on what's contained in the diary. And there you'll see CAF make a distinction and say the judge also prevented the appellant from cross-examining the victim on the language, and therefore constitutional rights are implicated. And under the facts of this case, given that she was confronted and cross-examined on it, the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply. The United States is making the argument here today that it was a non-constitutional prejudice standard. You'll see in our brief, we briefed it as harmless beyond a reasonable doubt just because we don't believe it rises to that anyway. Now, I'll also direct this court to Best and Binns, which talks about the constitutional right to present a defense. We still don't believe that that raises constitutional implications because she was cross-examined on it, as well as the fact that the appellant had the ability to testify if he so desired. Based on the facts of this case, it's a non-constitutional burden. Either way, there simply is no prejudice. The witness was cross-examined on it line by line. They would have had the same strength of authorship email in trial. And so the strength of the authorship of the email would have been decimated. They would have came to the same conclusion that hopefully this court does when they read the record, it's that SH fabricated the email. Then what does the email actually say? No admittance to perjury or fabrication. It's just bias and aversion towards appellant and his family. That was put on in the defense's case throughout their case. They put on bias, J.O.'s bias and motive against appellant. They put it on through J.O.'s cross about difficult marriage and struggling, abuse, arguments, physical violence, destroying his clothing and defecating on them. She was crossed on ongoing custody and how that related to the court proceedings. Then you have the testimony of S.H. on custody, her opinion of appellant and her wife. Testimony by S.H. that she heard J.O. use the same sort of descriptors racially that is in the email. All of that evidence was in front of them already, and you'll see it in the closing arguments. Trial counsel had to address this in his closing argument, this theory that J.O. was so biased and motivated against appellant that this was a conspiracy. You will see defense counsel argue it at length. Trial counsel has to address it at 1470, and then defense counsel argues it at length at 1498, and then 1502 to 05. It was a theme throughout his closing. Nothing would have progressed differently. Regardless if this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard or material or non-constitutional standard, there simply is no prejudice. Now, if there are no further questions on authentication, I'd like to move on to issue six. The appellant has not demonstrated that his counsel's strategic decisions amounted to an ineffective assistance at trial, nor has he demonstrated prejudice in this case. Obviously, the standard of when it comes to IAC, it's a high standard. Appellant has the burden to both show ineffective assistance as well as prejudice. And this is especially the case when we're talking about strategic or tactical decisions. Strickland, the Supreme Court, identified that counsel have wide latitude in making these decisions. I'd like to first address the argument regarding mention of the previous trial. You'll see defense counsel shape this issue by filing a motion and winning. Their goal was to hold the key to opening the door to this evidence. You actually won't just see that in their declarations, but also throughout the record of trial. R at 162, 259 to 60, 697, where they mention, "We understand we hold the keys to this, Your Honor." They didn't just make this decision with cavalier. They just consulted with their expert and appellant. They sat down and made a decision. They weighed the cost, benefits, risk associated, and made a call. That is the definition of strategic and tactical decisions, and it's simply unchallengeable. Appellant definitely has not demonstrated prejudice in this case because of the instruction given by the military judge. The military judge's instruction, you see the discussion at 286 to 87, and then she instructs the members at, 986 to 97, and then she instructs the members at 992 to 94. She tells them that the members they have to be guilty or not guilty based on the evidence in front of them, the prior trial, not evidence of guilt or sentencing. She pulls this from United States v. Rhodes, a decision from this case, or excuse me, this court, 64 MJ 630. She pulls the language directly out of that case. And then, on top of her instructions, what she told the parties, this is how you can use this. It's contextual. And you'll see that in the rest of the case, the closing arguments, the prior trial, any reference to confinement, anything of that nature was merely contextual. Trial counsel's argument uses it when he talks about how many times the victim testified. Defense counsel uses reference to the prior trial in his closing to attempt to put on a continued motive to fabricate on part of the parties. There's simply no prejudice. The members acknowledged on the record that they understood and followed the instruction. They're presumed to follow it, and there's no evidence to the contrary. Now, in regards to the character evidence, you have the same thing. This case is unique because trial defense counsel had the previous trial that they could see what didn't work. where appellant was convicted of molesting both victims. They could open up the trial and see what did and didn't work. You'll see in their declarations that they considered that character evidence was used in the first trial. It must also be acknowledged that appellant testified in the first trial. That didn't work. Those two things in combination failed. In this case, they would have been putting up character evidence without his testimony in a case where he's alleged to have molested a young child. It simply wasn't the case for it, and they looked at the prior trial and made their decision. That in and of itself ends the discussion on ineffective assistance of counsel.
Was good military character raised as a defense in the first trial?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. I believe it was character for truthfulness and good military character, and the appellant testified, and he was convicted on both charges. So they got to see what did and didn't work. They made a call as far as if this would take away from their case, if it would cause a distraction, on top of being concerned about have you heard questions. It didn't come out in detail, which could have in have you heard questions, but on the record is the fact that appellant was alleged to have committed adultery against J.O. with someone who's not his current wife, that he physically abused her and verbally abused her. With every single character witness, the members would have been repeatedly confronted with information that he engaged in this sort of activity, and with the charged offenses. They could be used with have you heard questions. As far as anyone that wrote an affidavit, there was nothing prohibiting trial counsel from calling them to question them in front of the members. This is a sort of thing where, in certain cases, good military character can work. Maybe a naked urinalysis where you have a rock star officer who's never been in trouble. This wasn't that case. It was far from it. They made the call, and it can't be challenged. And for the same reasons, he has not demonstrated prejudice. Here you have someone that was accused of molesting a child when they were alone and by themselves. It simply wasn't the case for character evidence. As far as the credibility of the victims, you could see the declarations and defense counsel's reasoning there. They weren't going to cross-examine the victim about whether or not she lied about her homework. They made a call about what that was going to do to their case, what the perception from the members was going to be, and the fact that they didn't want to overreach. Once again, that's the sort of decisions that the Supreme Court and CAF has said that courts aren't supposed to look at with hindsight. Based on those circumstances, appellant has not demonstrated that his counsel were ineffective, nor has he demonstrated any reasonable probability of prejudice from their decisions. If there's no further questions on ineffective assistance of counsel, I'd like to briefly turn to Issue 1, MRE 414. Even if this court were to toss aside the military judge's ruling in whole and start fresh, it's clear that this evidence was admissible under MRE 414. This court need look no further than Ettinger, Schroeder, and Baer for that argument. Ettinger, prior molestation 4 to 7 years before the charged act, stepdaughter or guardian capacity for both charged and uncharged victims, similar molestation, CAF found no error. Schroeder, charged with raping daughter, indecent acts with neighbor, offered molestation of stepdaughter from 6 years earlier, no error in admission. Baer, charged with molesting daughter, prior molestation of sister between approximately 17 years prior to the charged offenses, no error in admission. This court could completely set aside the military judge's decision, which is abuse of discretion, the idea that there's a presumption of admissibility, the fact that she used the correct law and balancing test. These incidents were shockingly similar and are exactly the type of evidence 414 was created to admit. As far as the 404B analysis, you've seen the United States brief contending that it was not an error. But to address that, this court can look once again to United States v. Baer, and that's CAF's decision in that case. They didn't even address the 404B analysis because it was clearly admissible under 414.
All right, and so, let me ask you this then. If we find that the military judge erred and the MP allegation should not have been admitted under MRE 414, does 404B potentially save this, or does it not save it then because it was admitted for propensity purposes and the members may have incorrectly used that evidence? In other words, I'm wondering on either case, does 404B either save you if 414 was wrong, and then ultimately I'll ask the appellant whether or not 44B even matters unless 414, you know, 44B even matters.
Your Honor, let me answer your premises, the second one first and the first one. You see, United States v. Baer Calf explains that since 414 is a more general and lenient rule of admissibility, that anything that comes in under 404 is in for 414 if we're talking about child molestation. I think you can use that reasoning to answer the second part, that the 404B does not matter. Any argument that it polluted her ruling, it's not persuasive. She goes through every single right factor. As I stated before, even if you set it all aside, this stuff, a de novo review determines that this is readily acceptable evidence. As far as 404B saving it, the United States brief argues that this was permissible to bring in for the charged intent. We've cited the adverse case law in that regard, but also I think it was even in Berry, Calf said that there was intent. And in Berry, they threw out the offered evidence under a 403 analysis, but not 404. Here, appellant was charged. His charge included intent, and our argument is it was relevant for that purpose.
And what, it was an intent to what? Under the facts of this case, what did the government have to prove the intent? I'm trying to figure out how this is helpful to the government for purposes of showing intent.
Well, once again, the argument would be that his prior molestation evidences a sexual intent to molest children, not in a propensity respect, but just sort of this idea of to satisfy sexual desires. I think it becomes most powerful when you look at the allegation that his penis touched her leg, I believe, when they were in the computer room.
Right, and of course, I think there were, three or four other allegations that were overtly sexual. I mean, digital penetration, and I guess my question is, how helpful is this for that purpose when it just seems like the acts as described themselves would indicate an intent to gratify their sexual desires?
Well, Your Honor, I would just recognize that it's an abuse of discretion standard. A military judge found it helpful, and so we'd have to, was her decision within a reasonable range of choices? And we would argue, yes, it was. But once again, I think bare evidence is this idea that if it comes in under 414, there's no reason to even address the 404B. You'll see that she mentions things in her 414 about non-propensity purposes, such as intent. There's nothing that prohibits her from doing so. In fact, the rules state that the evidence itself can be used for any purpose. So if evidence comes in under 414, it can be considered for things like intent, plan, motive, modus operandi, that sort of thing. And that intent finding there should be separated from the 404, right? 404 requires Reynolds and all this other stuff. In that relevancy determination, we're talking about 401 and 402. So she can state that there's some relevancy in regards to intent, and it's as an idea separate from the requirements of 404B.
What are we to make of the fact that nowhere in 414, the rule itself, does the word propensity appear? Is that of any meaning whatsoever? I mean, it seems that the assumption is whenever we're talking 414, it's propensity, we can argue propensity, no problem. Whereas before 413 and 414 came on the stage, that was the one thing you couldn't do, and that was the big fear, is that whether it was under 404B, and it's very much had been a concern in the balancing test under 403, the fear was is that the members were going to convict based on propensity, and we have to avoid that. Suddenly 413 and 414 come on the scene, and now it's Katie bar the door, propensity is in, and we can argue it. But the word propensity does not appear in either 413 or 414. All that's there is that if it comes in, it can be used for any purpose that is otherwise permitted, or words to that effect. So what are we to make of it, the fact that the word propensity does not appear in the rule itself?
I think the last part of your question there, Your Honor, answers that. It's that it opened up the aperture, and for any purpose includes propensity, it includes intent. And then, of course, it may not be in the rule itself, but and I don't have the analysis on me, Your Honor, but I can tell you through the entire legislative history of 414, that is what it was intended to open up on. There was a discussion of 404B and the limiting nature of it. It wasn't designed to exclude intent or plan or motive, and it wasn't intended to include propensity. It was to open up the aperture on what this specific evidence could be used for, and it's for any relevant purpose. And so I think the argument that there was a concern that propensity was too relevant and could be prejudicial shows you that anything relevant includes propensity. Now, that's kind of a circular way of looking at it, but that, I think, in and of itself identifies this idea that it can be used for propensity.
Well, and of course, we're not really concerned about being prejudicial. The whole point of the government's case is to be prejudicial and prove their case.
Yes,
it's unfairly prejudicial is the balancing test, correct?
Right. Yes, Your Honor. And I think here, as I stated, the propensity part of it is the discussions that came up when it was first enacted was this idea that this stuff was on 404B determined this was unfairly prejudicial because it was relevant. I think you see that in some cases. And so anything that is relevant, it can be used for anything relevant, includes propensity based on that idea.
So we shouldn't be concerned by the fact that there are appellants out there that are convicted based strictly on propensity to commit a crime as opposed to evidence directly proving the crime itself?
Well, Your Honor, they wouldn't be. The propensity evidence, the members are instructed that if there's a lack of reasonable doubt in a part of the government's case, the propensity evidence can't be used to shore that up. I think when you look at this case and how the evidence made the government's case extremely strong and powerful is the similarities between the two substantiated CG's testimony. It's not that, for instance, if a victim testifies that there was no penetration, you can put as many victims as you want in that trial, you're still not going to be able to substantiate the penetration element. That is what that instruction means. However, if the victim says, I was penetrated, and then you have three victims come in and say, he penetrated me in the same manner, it makes her testimony extremely believable. And that's what you have here. When this court goes to consider prejudice, either for authentication issue or any of the issues in this case, what you have is reliable, consistent testimony by two separate witnesses that appellant sexually molested them under similar circumstance. Their testimony, no real change over 14 years as far as their substance of experiences. Any inconsistencies identified throughout trial were explained by their age at the time of the offenses, the amount of time since had occurred, or they were insignificant in nature. If you want to see how well these victims did in this case, whether it's MP or CG, read their cross and then compare it to the cross-examination of SH. You will see two extremely powerful, credible testimonies that held up under cross-examination compared to one that did not. That demonstrates just how powerful and how credible they were. There was no bias or motive to fabricate on behalf of these two exposed. And Senior Judge Brown, when you were asking about prejudice in regard to the authentication issue, it must be identified that the defense's theory, the best one that they could come up with given the evidence, but still, was J.O. was a tangential witness. The bias and motive that they were attempting to put on related to the mother of an uncharged victim. It's tangential in nature. That's what they had to work with, but in the face of the evidence, it was overwhelming. That's why they had to pull for something like that, is because there was really no other answer, other than you have two credible victims who were molested under the same circumstances because that's what appellant did. CG's testimony is also corroborated. Prosecution Exhibit 3 shows previous consistent statements made to a medical examiner that was admitted for its substance. You also have her testimony with the church picnic being corroborated by the testimony of her mother, describing when the church picnic was, the fact that she was over there, as well that she came back with two gifts, a Full House DVD and a spy watch. Once again, there was simply no credible bias or motive to fabricate on behalf of these girls. Then any argument that a conspiracy existed deteriorated with time. CG was 17 to 18 years old when she testified, and MP was an adult security guard with her own child. Thus, if this court finds error in any of the issues, briefed or argued, there is simply no prejudice. And if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Yes.
Appellant's conviction and sentence was not the result of error in the admission or exclusion of evidence or ineffective assistance of counsel, but instead was the result of the credible and corroborated testimony of two child victims proving appellant's guilt well beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
Close, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin with a hypothetical that my brother on the other side offered, which is that the email might as well have come from an org box. Well, indeed, that's the question. Did the email come from the org box? And the question of whether or not the person accused of sending it actually sent it is the credibility issue for the members. They can decide it wasn't. And that's the sort of instruction they would have gotten from the military judge. If you find that she sent these emails, you may consider them as evidence of her prejudice against the accused.
But isn't it a threshold relevancy question that the email must have come from the ex-wife? Because isn't that why it's relevant? If it had come from of the four people, if it came from either of the three, then it wouldn't have been relevant. And wasn't what the judge trying to do here is determine whether it met the low threshold to at least establish prima facie case that it came from the only person to whom it would have been relevant. And if the evidence didn't establish at least that, then whatever else the document established, it would have been an irrelevant piece of evidence, would it not?
Well, and one thing, Chief Judge, is that all of the cases cited by both of the parties emphasize that it's a low bar to admissibility. So, yes, there had to be some evidence that it could have come from her. And there was that. It was from her email account. And while they went like this and they pointed at each other, we call that up in Boston the Beacon Hill salute. At the end of the day, that was a question for the members to determine who it came from. And this was also a theme of the defense throughout closing. This is something that government counsel just emphasized, but they had to argue that theme without the evidence to support it.
In counsel, the government, in addition to the government, depending on how you look at their argument against the authenticated, as to why they believe that the email was not authenticated, they also pointed to the IP addresses being a little bit different and not being able to understand whether or not that might have something to do, and then also referenced OH, who was the, I guess, potential recipient or maybe one of the individuals that might benefit from this this email in addition to the appellant, that that she had sent an email where she talked about the potential of manipulating, that computers could be manipulated and those kinds of things. So what I'm driving is this, is that the government seemed to be, although the push of their argument was, it's going to be either SH or it's going to be JO that wrote this email. They also seem to raise up some questions regarding whether or not this email was even a legitimate email and even came from that email address. Was there anything, to the extent that was raised, was there anything that the appellant put on to demonstrate that this, in fact, was an email and it had not been spoofed and it was what it purported to be?
Beyond the fact that they logged into the email account, the Yahoo account, and the webmail interface there and did that, I don't think so, Your Honor. But again, I don't think that was at the core of the military judge's ruling. The core of the ruling was credibility, and if that's a rule that this court announces, we respectfully believe that it's a rule without limit. I mean, it's a very problematic rule. The defense bar may cheer it, but it is not a workable rule, and the error is clear in this case. The question of prejudice, I did begin by saying that the question of prejudice on that was close. But on a different issue, the question is not so close, and that is the admission of NP's allegation for propensity purposes. This court does not need to draw a bright line for how recent an uncharged allegation must be in order to be admissible under MRE 413 or 414. You only need conclude that under the facts of this case, including the way the propensity evidence was used and the arguments of trial counsel, admission of the uncharged allegation of NP was unfair because it unduly and inflammatory characterized Captain Hudson as a child molester. Propensity evidence, as a fundamental principle of law, does not relieve the government of its burden of proving every element of the charged offense. In this case, however, propensity evidence was used as a substitute for evidence of the charged offense. For example, in closing argument, trial counsel insisted that a big part of why you have the elements you need and why you know the accused did this is because of the similarities and what the accused did to these two different girls. That's record at 1474. Now, the hypothetical that my brother on the other side offered about propensity to prove penetration, but you cannot use propensity to overcome an honest misgiving, a lack of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that penetration occurred. That's the substance, that's the meat of the instruction that is given to every member. So you can't say on one hand propensity is evidence that the crime happened, but on the other hand it's evidence that the crime didn't happen. That's exactly the sort of issue that caused the problem that CAF addressed in Hills. That's exactly the sort of issue that makes propensity evidence very difficult and something that must be approached with caution. And Chief Judge Drew, I'd like to address a question you asked along those lines. You said, isn't this the type of evidence, fundamentally I think you asked, isn't this the type of evidence that the rule allows? I mean, what was Congress trying to do with these rules in the federal system? And our answer is that just because the rule allows it doesn't mean it's always allowed. Propensity evidence has to be balanced under 403 against the danger of undue inflammatory rhetoric used to result in a conviction that's fundamentally unfair. That's CAF's concern throughout Wright and all of its case law looking at this issue. And that concern is rooted in the application of the balancing test under 403. And the legislative history shows that the rule is unquestionably subject to 403. Now, it's not expected that evidence under 414 would often be excluded under 403, but the government's position is that such evidence may never be excluded under 403, and that's clearly wrong. We believe that this case presents a clear example of where the 403 factors should have prevented admission. And I've raised a number of them in our briefs.
Yeah, and Captain, I think you're going here, but I just want to zone you in. Is put aside the judge's analysis and the judge's rulings. I think you would agree that even if the judge's analysis was incorrect, if this court determined that it was properly admissible under MRE 414, then you would not prevail. So why should this court find that this allegation by MP should not be admitted under MRE 414?
Well, fundamentally, Senior Judge Brown, for the reasons that we highlight in our brief, and I want to pick out two of them in particular, which is the excessive weight to the fact that he was previously considered and the lack of temporal proximity. The fact that he was previously convicted is troubling as a factor to consider for the admissibility of this, because in the first trial, the charged offenses were used for propensity purposes. Now, the military judge did not have the benefit of CAF's decision in Hills, but this court does. And so looking at that earlier conviction, that is not a basis to say that it should be admissible later. There were certainly many other errors that the defense raised.
But wouldn't it be fair, if we're just talking generally, is that at that prior trial, the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that prior incident occurred, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right, okay. So whereas for purposes of propensity under 414, it would just be by preponderance of the evidence. So he was found guilty based on a much higher standard at the earlier trial than the judge even had to apply in this particular case, correct?
Well, so we don't agree with that, Your Honor, because of the issues with the charged offenses being used for propensity purposes, the damage that did to his presumption of innocence, and the many other issues that were raised in the appeal of that case. I mean, that case ended with a summary disposition from CAF, so we don't know sort of the resolution of many of those issues, but we don't think that those convictions were proper.
Okay, fair enough. But
And Your Honor, I'm sorry if I could, and this relates a bit to the IAC issue as well, and the danger of using the first trial as some sort of metric by which the second trial can be measured. In the first trial, and there's some significant differences between the first trial and the second trial. Three in particular stand out. Captain Hudson testified in his own defense in the first trial, and the members could have properly convicted him just because they didn't believe his testimony. The charged offenses, as I mentioned, were used for propensity purposes, and character evidence was not a central theme in the first trial, but it was a central theme in the second.
All right, and you're not arguing that it shouldn't at least be a factor, are you? I mean, I can see your position where you say it shouldn't be a litmus test of if he was convicted before, therefore it's got to come in, it definitely happened. But the fact that he was convicted by members who had the opportunity to personally observe the credibility of MP, are you disagreeing with the assertion that it shouldn't at least be a factor that might be considered in determining whether or not that prior incident was more likely than not to have occurred?
No, Your Honor, because we think that the 403 factors are very broad. I mean, any list of them gets longer and longer every time it's written out. Our concern is that the military judge gave excessive weight to that factor.
All right. So for purposes of this court, putting aside the judge's ruling and giving you a shot to go, all right, forget what the judge did. Appellate court, this is why this is inadmissible under MRE 414. And what I hear you saying primarily is the passage of time.
We do think that the passage of time, and I see that my time has expired, Your Honor.
The passage of time has expired, but go ahead and ask the question.
And we do think that the passage of time is a significant factor because of the way it was used. I mean, what this court has the benefit of now is the hindsight of the entire record, and most particularly the trial counsel's closing argument and the way they tied together these two allegations to assert it as one single course of conduct that showed that appellant was guilty and created a fundamentally unfair trial. Perhaps the military judge could have admitted this with a limitation. I mean, this is sort of where the 404B question comes in. We don't think 404B saves 414 because of the limitations in 404B. There was no limitation here. This was an unlimited admissibility, and it's very hard to look at this record and draw the contours of what this was actually admissible to prove. The government asserts to you that because it's admissible for any purpose to which it is relevant, as the rule says, that means it's admissible for any purpose. But we don't think that the rule goes that far, and we think that the military judge certainly had a duty to limit its admission in this case. Absent any further questions, Your Honors, that concludes our presentation.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.